Good morning. I'm speaking with Osama Khalil about his new book, A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad from Kennedy to Biden. Khalil is chair of the International Relations Program and senior research associate of the Middle Eastern Studies Program at Syracuse University. Among other publications, he's the author of America's Dream Palace, Middle East Expertise and the Rise of the National Security State, which was named by Foreign Affairs as a best book of 2017. He's been a frequent contributor to various media, including the Huffington Post, Los Angeles Times, The Hill, Al Akbar, and Al Jazeera. Welcome to KABU, Osama Khalil.
Thanks, Lori. Happy to be here.
Well, your book offers a masterful historical overview of U.S. foreign policy since the war in Vietnam. Why do you begin your story with the Kennedy administration in Vietnam, and how have the so-called lessons of Vietnam continued to influence policymakers in ways that don't indicate any lessons have been learned?
Well, that's very kind of you to say, and it's also a great question, and it's one I struggled with when I was writing the book about where to start the story. And you know, there are several starting points one could pick, particularly in the post-World War II era. And what I decided was that the Kennedy presidency, and of course, then the Kennedy assassination, has a profound impact on American society and American political culture. And what's interesting about it is we have, you know, Kennedy's soaring inaugural address that inspires a whole generation of baby boomers, many who will go into government service inspired by that inaugural address, and then will be forced in different agencies, State Department, CIA, defense, et cetera, and will then be faced with the Vietnam War. And that will become their key testing ground. And what I describe in the book and what I came to see was that many of those key figures would stay in these different agencies, whether they stayed in the Foreign Service or in and out of government, would return to the Vietnam War experience for better or worse. They didn't always draw the same conclusions from the war, but invariably they kept coming back to that experience and applying it to different conflicts over the next six decades. The other aspect of the Kennedy presidency, I think that's interesting, that I can talk a little more about specifically on Vietnam, is, you know, Kennedy is going to put in several different attempts at several things in Vietnam that will have long-term implications. One, not just for his presidency, but then after the assassination, President Johnson, and then President Nixon. And that includes counterinsurgency initiatives. It includes, you know, the overthrow and assassination of the U.S. ally, Ngo Dinh Diem, the president of South Vietnam, all of which have long-range implications for America's involvement in Vietnam and leaves, you know, a really difficult challenge for Johnson and Nixon to deal with. And as I argue in the book, they don't really deal with it well. There's also attempts to then contain, as the Vietnam War is failing, to contain its impact globally, not just in Southeast Asia, not just even the countries, you know, neighboring Vietnam, but across what we now call the Global South, but the Third World. And I look at some of those test cases, those case studies rather, in the Middle East, Southern Africa, and Latin America. The other aspect, and this is a thread through the book, is the role of decline. And so this is something that differentiates, for example, the Korean War from the Vietnam. Even though the Korean War ends in a stalemate, if not an American loss, it doesn't have this impact on the American psyche. In fact, you know, at the end of the Eisenhower presidency, you could argue America believed and American policymakers viewed America's place in the world as unbounded, had not been impacted by the Korean War in any substantial way. In fact, what we see is that some of the aspects of what was attempted in the Korean War are brought into Vietnam and other conflicts. Vietnam is quite different. And instead, what we see is an existential crisis, for lack of a better term. That's effectively what we see by the 1970s, the post-Vietnam, post-Watergate, post-Kennedy assassinations, as well as the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and other key figures. Then, you know, you can compare it to how the baby boomers were inspired by Kennedy and are now, in a sense, view the America's place in the world quite differently. And the question that comes about in the 70s, and we'll see it again in the 80s at the end of the Reagan presidency, we'll see it again in the 90s. I talk about it by 2008 and then the Trump presidency, again and again, the idea that America is in decline. And whether it's real or perceived, it has a profound impact. And we can trace that to an effect, and I do in the book, to the Vietnam era.
You also argue that domestic and foreign policies are closely intertwined, which is something most Americans don't really think about. I mean, sadly, most Americans don't think about foreign policy or pay attention to what the United States is doing around the world. What are some of the links you make between the wars on terror, drugs, and crime?
It's a great question. So the way we as scholars and historians and tend to view these spheres, the domestic sphere and the foreign policy sphere, as separate and distinct. And I dealt with a little bit of this in my first book, and I wanted to come back to it more in this book, which is to look at how they influence each other. How do domestic politics and domestic policy influence foreign policy? How have they been exported on things like crime, drugs, and terror? And how have those wars come back home? How has foreign policy come back home and then influenced domestic policy? So that's a key thread through the book. So one of the things we'll see, for example, and this will be intuitive to your readers, which is that crime and drugs are often linked, right? And so what we'll see, though, is that the war on crime is directly linked to the Vietnam War. So here's a case where you have the Vietnam War coming home in Johnson's announcement of a war on crime. But many of those policies, which become amplified over the next six decades. And so what I trace out is also this idea of the very real reality of militarized policing at home that's connected to a militarized foreign policy abroad, and that these influence each other. And so we can trace the militarized policing to the Johnson administration. And then, of course, the war on drugs. Now, you have several different starting points for the war on drugs that you could trace to the post-World War II era, to prohibition, et cetera. Where I pick up, of course, is Johnson and Nixon, and in particular, Nixon, and him taking a lot of that kind of prohibition era focus on the war on drugs and really amplifying. And it's Nixon who's going to become the template, particularly for other Republican presidents like Reagan, like Bush, but not just, because we also see with Bill Clinton, a Democrat who fully embraces Nixon's law and order approach, amplifies the war on crime, amplifies the war on drugs. And what your listeners may also not realize is that how the U.S. dealt with terror, both abroad and at home, and I described the several different mini wars on terror that occurred before 9/11, but the terror was often at home dealt with as a criminal justice issue, and that is abandoned after 9/11. It becomes fully militarized. And at the same time, through these mini wars on terror that we see under Nixon, under Reagan, and then again, as it picks up after 9/11, is a fully militarized response in which diplomacy is not the priority. Instead, what we're seeing is we're still learning much more about this than I could get to in the book, about the types of interventions that the U.S. was conducting, including using special forces or a combination of special forces teams with CIA to combat, quote unquote, terrorist organizations overseas as they were defined by the U.S. So these three interlink. And what we see is the impact also, for example, when we think about crime and narcotics, the use of how important things like informants are, and in cases where they may or may not be credible informants. And we see that again with the war on terror. We see that in the response to 9/11, how the Bush administration and the Bush Justice Department is so eager to find victories in the war on terror at home, that we'll see the use of unscrupulous informants. We'll see the use of high profile cases that end up being much less than they are initially, you know, depicted to the press, with these grand indictments, you know, 400 count indictments of professors, of charities. And then it turns out that there's not really a lot there. So those are some of the things I tease out in the book. And I think will also, I think, surprise your readers. There are other aspects that, for example, have been erased from history, the Abu Ghraib scandal. And this provides us a direct link between how we've dealt with the war on crime at home, mass incarceration, so both crime and drugs and mass incarceration, and then the impact of that on foreign policy. So for your listeners who may not remember or may not know about the Abu Ghraib scandal, Abu Ghraib was one of the notorious prisons in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. It becomes an American prison after the U.S. invasion and occupation. And then a deliberate decision is made at the Guantanamo Bay prison, at the Bagram Air Base prison in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and several black sites, that the U.S., quote unquote, needs to get tough with the detainees. This is how you break the insurgencies, the global insurgencies, as it's being described, the global jihad. And in Iraq, what's happening at Abu Ghraib is some 80%, we come to find out, of the prisoners were not tied to this emerging and growing insurgency in Iraq. In fact, they were, you know, petty criminals. Some of them weren't involved in anything. And this is a case where, again, we'll see this in Afghanistan and Iraq, what becomes known effectively as a bounty, right? So what is the United States doing? U.S. military, U.S. intelligence been offering bounties for anyone who can give information on a potential member of the insurgency. And so, of course, if you have a grudge, if you have some kind of issue with another individual, if you just want the money, you're turning over individuals and they're getting arrested. So the decision is made now to be tough on the detainees.
It seems kind of reminiscent of U.S. policies in general.
Oh, sure.
The torture proven to be ineffective. I mean, doesn't end in any kind of results that might be desired, but yet torture is continued to be used. And these interventions over and over again don't achieve anything that's useful to the United States, but yet policymakers continue to intervene in just about every corner of the globe. I wanted to ask about the two main sections of your book. You frame your narrative within these two categories, the firefighters and the Badlands. Do you want to say something about why you decided to frame this history within these categories?
Sure. And I think it's a great question. So the first half, which deals with the Cold War era, so that the Vietnam War to the end of the Reagan presidency is under the part one of the firemen. And this is based on a Kennedy speech regarding Vietnam. So one of the things I'm looking at there is this perception, the self-perception that the United States is out fighting fires, right? These Cold War era fires that are popping up around the globe. And they're often doing it without, as Kennedy will describe, kind of haphazardly out, you know, really the thanks of those countries that the United States has intervened in part because they're so shell-shocked by this interventions that occurred. And this is, you know, his own description that he will give at a pro-Vietnam group that's bipartisan, that's opposed to the division of Vietnam into two countries, that what becomes known as the Geneva Accord. So what I look at there is the United States' interventions really also related to the Vietnam War in the sense that they're attempting to contain the impact of the Vietnam War. And what I argue in there is that the United States also serves to entrench these conflicts throughout the Cold War. So whether that is in Southeast Asia, it's in South Asia, it's in the Middle East, it's in Latin America, Southern Africa, that there were other options available. And I discussed those. You know, Southern Africa, as I described, is a great example. The Middle East is another great example of where the United States could have, in fact, should have, adopted a different approach and didn't. And so that's part one. In part two, with the Badlands, what I then talk about is how the United States looked at these urban areas, its own domestic urban areas, and described an unwillingness to deal with key issues related to social problems and related to that crime, drugs, mental health issues, et cetera, and has started to define by the 80s and 90s these urban areas as Badlands. Now, some of this takes us back to the Prohibition era, because that's where this term was first applied, drawing on the myth and the mythology of the American West, and then applying it to places like the South Side of Chicago during the Capone era. And then we see it reemerge in the 90s with the war on drugs, and then is transported abroad with the war on terror. So many of those same conflict zones I described in the Cold War, those conflicts have become entrenched, they haven't been resolved. And then by the post-Cold War era, especially the war on terror, these Badlands are now overseas in places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Gaza. And again, part of this is about an unwillingness, much like there's an unwillingness to deal with America's urban problems, to deal with these problems overseas, other than through military means or through militarized policing. So the Badlands, in effect, kind of blend this idea about domestic policy and foreign policy and their implications, and how much we see not just the policies that are being exported, but how we view those populations. How do you view a population that lives in the Badlands?
And it does seem like race and racism really undergird policies within the United States and abroad.
Exactly. And that's one of the things I try and trace out, is how much those perceptions of race, religious supremacy, or racial and religious inferiority are also influencing policymakers, how they view not just domestic arenas, but the arenas overseas. And so it becomes really difficult to distinguish between the quote-unquote global South or the third world during the Cold War, as well as America's urban areas. And we see that playing out, which is why the book ends with Biden, because we see it tracing out across 6 to 7 decades, if not earlier.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm speaking with Professor Osama Khalil about his important new book, A World of Enemies, America's Wars at Home and Abroad from Kennedy to Biden. So, how is war so embedded in the US economy, culture, and politics, but so invisible?
The book was completed before October 7th, but we've seen it really on full display since October 7th. For example, Janet Yellen, the Secretary of the Treasury, is asked, immediately after the October 7th attacks, can the United States afford to support wars in Ukraine and Israel? And without missing a beat, she says, absolutely. I think it's been demonstrated if you look at how President Biden has talked about the need for foreign assistance to Ukraine and Israel, and the fact that the Wall Street Journal, which agrees with President Biden on very little, if anything, absolutely agrees with him that foreign military assistance comes back to the United States in the form of jobs. So if you were to ask Americans today, are we at war? They would say no. In fact, President Biden just said this, proud to be the first American president to say we're not at war today. And yet the United States is active in five different war zones right now, whether it's Gaza, Somalia, Yemen, Syria, Iraq. The United States is active in Ukraine. The United States has special forces operations throughout the world, whether it's training or active kinetic operations. It has troops stationed in South Korea. It has a flotilla of naval ships, not only in and around the Persian Gulf and the Eastern Mediterranean, but in the Pacific. And yet Americans are told they're not at war, and yet they're actively deployed. Part of this also has to do with the fact that we have a volunteer military, and we have since the end of the Vietnam War. And so the footprint of it's very small. And the number of families that are impacted, we saw this during the Afghanistan and Iraq, is small, but it's profound, the impact of these conflicts. And you touched on in the beginning that Americans aren't really paying attention. And in fact, that's what policymakers want. As I talk about in the book, there's also this is again tied to these issues of race and racism, which is the demonization of the other that occurs. So Americans are constantly being told that they're faced this world of enemies, including some at home and a world of enemies abroad. And that is, and then how we describe those populations, again, whether they live in the Badlands or not, also feeds into these policies and this perpetual war machine.
So there's this demonization of individuals like Saddam Hussein or Vladimir Putin, and then we have faceless terrorists such as those in Lebanon or Hamas without any kind of legitimate goals or causes that they might champion.
Sure. Well, once you label a group as terrorist, then it's completely delegitimized, right? That delegitimizes any claim that they may have. I think you've heard this a lot since October 7th. I think the other aspect I would, really want your readers to think, or your listeners to think about, is the following, which is, how is it that Americans are told over and over again, we can't afford this, we can't afford that, we can't afford universal health care, we can't afford universal daycare, universal access to higher education, retirement, et cetera. But we can afford a $300 million fake pier that was built off of Gaza that provided very little humanitarian aid. It was essentially a prop for a special forces operation, right? In which 300 Palestinians were killed, an untold number of Israeli hostages were killed before Israeli hostages were rescued. And the reality there, and this is what I talk about in the book, is that we've allowed diplomacy to be completely enervated. And because we've allowed diplomacy to be deprioritized and enervated, it allows for this kind of militarized foreign policy, militarized humanitarian assistance, and the use of these kinds of props. Those hostages could have been released through negotiations, but that was something that the United States either didn't want to do or was unwilling to pay the price, the public relations price of those negotiations. And so I think what's also important here for the listeners to understand is that this also is related to, we talk about deprioritizing foreign policy, is America's insistence now on conflict management over conflict resolution. And so in many of these key areas I talk about in those Badlands, what the United States is no longer interested in is actual conflict resolution. It wants to manage these conflicts, kick the can down the road, and let it become somebody else's problem. If they can't deal with it in a military way, then and they're afraid that diplomacy is going to be too difficult, too many concessions. And so this is again that tie back to the Vietnam era, where the United States sought not negotiations with North Vietnam, but North Vietnamese surrender. And that was supposed to be done through the application of military force. And what I talk about is how we see those same applications again and again, and it's happening again today in Gaza.
Well, you point out that the United States has already spent more than $6 trillion on the war on terror and at least $1 trillion on the war on drugs. And there's no accounting for the costs on various countries and societies that have been destroyed and communities within the United States. But yet these fruitless policies of global interventions in wars and militarizing police and drug wars at home at such costs, but the United States continues, policymakers continue these practices. So why won't the United States pursue alternatives such as diplomacy or addiction treatment?
I think one of the issues that I talk about this in the book, and this is again the influence of domestic politics, where part of it's about a domestic political cycle, the 2-year, 4-year cycle. The belief, when we talk about how crime has been applied to both drugs and terror, being tough on crime, tough on drugs, tough on terror, is often seen as a requirement for political office. The belief that this is what the American public wants to hear and reassures them. And as I talk about in the book, particularly at the end, we've seen this cycle again and again when it comes to the, for example, midterm elections, how the threat of crime, the threat of a migrant horde, the threat of these different constant threats are used in particular, and it's not just Republicans, but are used by different political figures and candidates to really amplify their get tough approach. And so that's one aspect of this. The other aspect, as I talk about, is we have had, and we've seen this with the militarized foreign policy, is that you can trace out a series of war hawk secretaries of state. And this seems to be a requirement that you have to be tough as a secretary of state, right? And that's not the role of the secretary of state. That's America's chief diplomat. And yet what we've seen is whether it's Dean Rusk in Vietnam, or it's Hillary Clinton under Obama, or it's Anthony Blinken today, or Condoleezza Rice, for example, under the Bush administration. This idea that diplomacy and the military are going hand in glove, right? And that we can't separate these, that diplomacy is not good, if anything, is rarely a carrot anymore, but is just a less blunt stick. And so standing behind diplomacy is this force of the American military. But as I talk about in the book, that's also tied to these perceptions of decline, because as the United States continues to intervene abroad, when it doesn't get the result that it thinks it's going to get through military force, or that it has promised the American public, it adds into this perception of decline. And what that also does is it's the paradox, the belief that more force is needed instead of less force. And a great example of that is occurring right now in Yemen with U.S. airstrikes. And there's a moment back in January when the United States launched airstrikes against Ansar Allah, the Houthi movement, in which President Biden is asked, are the airstrikes working? And he will say, are the airstrikes working? Do you mean that they are deterring the Houthis? No, they're not. Will they continue? Yes. And that fundamentally sums up U.S. foreign policy, at least for the past 3 decades, I would argue, taking us back to the Vietnam era, because that's precisely the same kind of logic that drove, for example, in Vietnam, Operation Rolling Thunder, which was the bombing campaign of North Vietnam, which then continued to escalate from 1965 into 68, 69. And the idea there was, quote unquote, make North Vietnam beg for peace. And when that didn't work, what do? Bomb them harder. And instead of looking at what's at the root cause, and in part, one of the other aspects we've seen is part of the political culture in Washington, whether it's Vietnam in under Johnson, or Iraq under the Bush administration, or Gaza today, alternate voices are not being listened to within the bureaucracy. In fact, they're deliberately shut out. That was the case under Johnson. That was the case under Bush. That's the case today with Biden.
Well, what about the role of the military-industrial complex behind all this? Isn't there some kind of material economic incentive for continuing and promoting wars?
Well, absolutely. And I touch on a little bit on that in the book. It's something I'm working on in a subsequent project. And then the question is, of course, and this ties back to the point I made earlier about President Biden fully promoting it, this idea that foreign military assistance comes home in the form of American jobs as part of why war is so invisible to most Americans, because they benefit from it on a daily basis. They benefit from it. If you have, if you have a pension plan, if you have a 401k, chances are you have investments in any index fund in any of the major military contractors, right? And so you benefit from it without really even knowing it. That doesn't even include those few Americans who actually invest directly in the stock market, invest directly in these military contractors, whether it's Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or any number. And so there's also those dual use companies, right? So something like SpaceX, right, which is fully reliant on government contracts. So we have had that deeply embedded in the U.S. economy and has been since post-World War II era. Gun manufacturing, the United States is the main gun manufacturer in the world and has been since the World War I era, right, in terms of the export of guns abroad. So, and this is one of those things that's deeply built into the US economy, but it's also built into political culture, whether it's video games, Call of Duty on down, any number of TV shows that are and movies that are produced. We talked about torture. And so even though torture hasn't been effective, it is presented as effective in any number of pop culture products, whether it's movies or TV shows. And I talk a little about that in the book, which is the exact opposite of what we're seeing, but it offers Americans this kind of idea that, oh, if there is this thorny problem, we can just torture the guy or woman and get the answer we need. And yet we've seen that doesn't work at all. So this is one of those aspects where when we think about the military industrial complex, what's also important about it is just how pervasive it is in the United States in the sense of where are these companies located, where are the factories located, and they're often located in key districts, and that's deliberate. So how do you get congressmen or congresswomen, representatives on board or key senators? Well, there's jobs in their districts, there's jobs in their states. And so once again, we see this as pervasive throughout the system and tied into American political culture and the American political calendar.
Well, just to wrap up here, Osama Khalil, you write a lot about the importance of diplomacy and advocating for diplomacy as solutions to wars abroad, and instead of militarizing the police, other kinds of alternatives with the drug wars, looking at treatment for addiction rather than punishment. What about grassroots groups and their mobilizations in terms of bringing about a shift in US foreign policy and other bad policies within the United States? I mean, what are ways in which we can shift this paradigm?
That's a great question, and it's a huge challenge. I think we're seeing some of that with this election, and I think you saw some of that with the grassroots movement around an uncommitted vote to send some kind of message back to the Biden campaign, the Biden White House, that the policy, for example, in the Middle East needs to change. And grassroots is really important, but it's also, as we know, really limited. Why? Again, back to the political calendar and the very reality, and we're seeing it with this presidential campaign. Of the vast amounts of money that are coming into the campaigns from wealthy individuals, from wealthy corporations, that's completely unchecked. So the power of grassroots individuals is in mobilizing and challenging those vast sums of money. You won't get equal weight. And we've seen that in the Democratic Party. I think we've seen that with what's about to happen with the convention, which is in fact to kind of cut out the role of activists and grassroots movements. Has decided to go with a virtual nomination process. So we're seeing democracy being diminished day by day, under the same time that we're being told that democracy is on the ballot. And also watching this massive amount of donor money that's coming in and what they may want. So the Peter Thiels of the world, or the Miriam Adelsons, who are funneling a lot of money into the Trump campaign, or on the other side, your Haim Sabahns and other wealthy individuals, or Jeffrey Katzenberg, et cetera. What they may want is not exactly what the average voter may want.
Yeah, or AIPAC just
Yeah.
defeating Cori Bush and really targeting all of those who have just voiced some opposition to Israel's genocide.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Osama Khalil. We'll link to your book, A World of Enemies: America's Wars at Home and Abroad, from Kennedy to Biden, on the Old Mole Variety Hour website. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Transmit the message to the receiver. Hope for an answer someday.